Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a really critical topic, spinal infections. These can be incredibly challenging to diagnose and manage.
Definitely. They're high stakes.
Absolutely. It's not just about finding the infection. It's understanding the anatomy, who's at risk, and making fast decisions. So we're going to talk about the spinal infection chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia. That's at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayette.
It's a fantastic resource.
It really is. But remember, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. You've got to read the book.
Crucial advice.
So our goal today is to build a kind of mental framework for these cases, starting with getting the location right, pinpointing it.
Exactly. That precision is key, especially for the sophisticated learner. Spinal infections, well, they can be really subtle early on.
Mm-hmm.
So understanding where the infection is really helps you figure out who's at risk and, you know, how it even got there in the first place.
Okay, so let's lay down the ground rules. Location, location, location. We've got three main areas right next to each other. What are the key terms we need?
Right. So if the infection's in the vertebral bone itself, that's vertebral osteomyelitis.
Got it. Osteomyelitis.
If it's really just confined to that disc space between the vertebrae, we call that discitis.
Discitis. Okay.
And then the one that really causes a lot of the neurological problems is the collection of pus in the epidural space,
mm-hmm.
kind of between the lining of the spinal cord and the bone. That's the spinal epidural abscess, or AAA.
AAA. And I guess bacteria don't always stay neatly in one spot.
Not usually, no.
Hmm.
Especially with bacterial infections, it's very common to see it affect both the disc and the bone right next to it. And that combination, that's spondylolisthitis.
Spondylolisthitis, makes sense.
And what's really interesting and kind of dictates the risk is the blood flow to these areas. There's a clear gradient.
Whoa. Tell me more.
Well, the epidural space is the most vascular. Lots of blood vessels there, which, you know, makes it easy for bacteria traveling in the blood to land there. It also makes it prone to septic thrombophlebitis, basically infected clots.
Okay, most vascular. Then what?
Then comes the bone, the vertebra itself. Pretty good blood supply. But the disc, the intervertebral disc, is actually the least vascular structure of the three, especially in adults.
Right. And that high vascularity in the epidural space, that's where the immediate danger comes in, isn't it? With the abscess.
Exactly. That abscess starts to grow in that tight space, and there's nowhere for that pressure to go except inwards, onto the spinal cord, onto the nerve roots.
Leading to potentially permanent damage, paralysis even.
Precisely. And that lack of blood supply in the adult disc, that actually ties directly into who gets what type of infection based on age.
How so?
Well, in kids, the center of the disc, the nucleus pulposus, it still has a pretty decent blood supply. So infections traveling in the blood tend to settle right there. That's why kids are more likely to present with pure discitis.
Okay, kids, discitis.
But as we get older, that nucleus pulposus becomes avascular. It loses its blood supply. So now, if bacteria arrive via the bloodstream, they can't really set up shop in the disc easily.
So they go for the bone instead.
Exactly. They preferentially settle in the vertebral bodies and the end plates, the parts of the bone right next to the disc. So in adults, the more common presentation is vertebral osteomyelitis, or that combined spondylolisthitis picture.
Okay, so we've got the where. Now, how does the infection actually get to the spine? You mentioned bloodstream.
Right, that's the main route. Hematogenous spread. Something from somewhere else in the body, a skin infection, UTI, whatever, seeds into the blood and travels to the spine. That's the vast majority.
What about other ways?
Well, less commonly you can get direct inoculation, maybe from sinus surgery, an epidural injection, or even penetrating trauma like a stab wound.
Iatrogenic causes, basically.
Yeah, or trauma. And there's contiguous spread. That means the infection is kind of creaking over from something right next door.
Like what?
Maybe a really bad bed sore, an infected sacral decubitus ulcer that spreads inwards. Or sometimes an abscess deep in the hip flexor muscle, the psoas muscle, can extend to the spine.
Interesting. And does it tend to hit certain parts of the spine more often?
Yes, definitely. Vertebral osteomyelitis loves the lumbar spine. That's the most common spot. After that, it's the thoracic spine, maybe 35% or so of cases. And the cervical spine, the neck, is the least common, only around 10%.
Good to know. Okay, the culprits, the bugs themselves, who are the usual suspects?
Number one, by a long shot, is Staphylococcus aureus. Gotta know that one. It accounts for probably half, maybe even more, of all cases.
Not Paris, got it.
Then second place, but quite a bit less common, is S. epidermidis, another type of staph.
Okay, but we can't just stop there, right? There are specific bugs linked to specific patient groups.
Absolutely critical point. You hear the patient's history, you think about specific bugs.
Yeah.
For example, if you isolate Pseudomonas, you immediately need to ask about IV drug use. That's a very strong link.
Pseudomonas and IV drug use. Okay.
And if it's Salmonella, you should be thinking about sickle cell disease, another classic association.
Right. And then there are the ones we need to consider more globally or in specific populations.
Yes. Tuberculosis, Pott's disease, hugely important worldwide, even if it's less common now in, say, the U.S. or Western Europe. But in endemic areas or in patients from those areas, you must consider TB.
Why is it so crucial to catch TB early?
Because delayed diagnosis can lead to massive bone destruction and this really severe, often irreversible spinal curvature, a bad kyphosis. You always need a chest x-ray if TB is on the radar.
Okay. And what about Brucella?
Brucella is another one, often linked to consuming unpasteurized dairy products, especially in endemic regions like the Mediterranean or Middle East.
And you mentioned it's tricky to see on imaging.
Yeah, it can be really subtle. Standard x-rays or even sometimes early MRI might not show obvious signs of osteomyelitis until it's pretty advanced. So you really need that clinical suspicion based on history, travel, diet.
Makes sense. And just quickly, the general risk factors that make someone more susceptible.
It's largely about compromised immunity or opportunity. So things like diabetes, being on immunosuppressant drugs, HIV, malignancy, just getting older, 4V drug use, as we mentioned, any recent spinal trauma or surgery, even underlying degenerative spine disease can increase the risk.
Okay, so let's talk about how these patients actually present, because this seems to be where things often go wrong. The symptoms sound kind of vague.
They really can be. The classic picture is severe back pain, often worse at night, doesn't get better with rest, maybe lasting more than a week, general malaise, feeling unwell, and sometimes fever.
But sometimes fever, that's the kicker, isn't it? Especially in adults with vertebral osteo.
Exactly. This is so important. Back pain, almost always there, over 85% of adult cases, but fever, reliable. Nope. Present in 50% or maybe even less.
Wow, half the time, no fever.
Right. And think about it. These patients often have severe pain, so what are they taking?
NSAIDs. Anti-inflammatories.
Which can mask a low-grade fever completely. So you can have this raging infection, but the thermometer looks normal or near normal. It leads to huge diagnostic delays.
That's scary. And then there's the supposed classic triad for the spinal epidural abscess. Fever, spinal pain, neurologic deficits. How often do you actually see all three together?
Almost never. That's the paradox. We teach the triad, but waiting for all three components to show up, well, you've likely missed the boat for preventing serious neurological damage.
So what is the most common presentation for SEA then?
Severe back pain is still number one. Fever, again, maybe only 50% of the time. And the neurologic deficits, the numbness, weakness, bowel, bladder issues, that's the most concerning sign. But it might only be present in about a third of patients initially.
So the real skill isn't spotting the full triad?
No. The real skill is having a high index of suspicion based just on that severe, persistent, non-mechanical back pain, especially if the patient has any of those risk factors we talked about. You have to think about infection early, even without fever or neurodeficits.
That high suspicion, despite vague signs, that's clearly the toughest part. And it highlights why having a structured approach like the one outlined in Orthopedia is so vital.
It really helps organize your thinking.
Absolutely. And just a reminder for everyone listening, we have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook Orthopedia at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Pinney, and Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Couldn't agree more. And we should quickly mention kids again. Diagnosing this in toddlers is incredibly hard.
Right. They can't just tell you, my back hurts.
Exactly. You might just see a refusal to sit up or stand or walk. Maybe they develop a painful limp or they resist any activity. Sometimes it even presents as sort of nonspecific abdominal pain because they can't localize that deep spinal pain well. It's tough.
Okay. Given how nonspecific the presentation can be, the diagnosis really relies on objective tests. Let's talk labs first.
Right. You're looking for signs of inflammation. The key ones are the acute phase reactants, ESR erythrocyte sedimentation rate, and CRPC reactive protein.
ESR and CRP, standard inflammation markers.
They're elevated in the vast majority, over 80% of cases. So they're good screening tools. If they're normal, spinal infection is less likely, though not impossible. But they're not specific. Lots of things cause inflammation.
What about procalcitonin, PCT? Is that helpful here?
Yes, PCT is increasingly recognized as valuable. It tends to be more specific for bacterial infections compared to ESR and CRP. So a high PCT can steer you more strongly towards a bacterial cause, maybe away from some non-infectious inflammatory mimics.
Okay, so ESR, CRP, maybe PCT for screening. What about their role in tracking progress?
That's where CRP really shines. The trend of the CRP level is probably our best non-invasive way to monitor if the treatment, usually antibiotics, is working. You want to see that CRP coming down steadily.
And if it's not, well, it starts going back up.
That's a red flag. It suggests your antibiotics might not be covering the right bug, or maybe there's an undrained abscess somewhere that needs dealing with.
What about a simple white blood cell count, WBC?
You know, surprisingly, it's only elevated in about half of patients with spinal infections.
Yeah.
So a normal WBC count absolutely does not rule out infection.
Okay, good point. Now, cultures. We need to know the bug. Blood cultures. Urine cultures.
Definitely get them. Blood cultures, maybe urine too. But here's the frustrating part. They only come back positive in about 50% of cases, maybe a bit more.
Only half the time. Wow.
Yeah. So it's critical to get them, but you can't rely on them being positive. And crucially, when do you get them?
Before antibiotics, if possible.
Exactly. If the patient is stable, not septic, you absolutely want to get those blood cultures before starting antibiotics. Giving antibiotics first can sterilize the blood in the infection site, making it much harder, sometimes impossible, to figure out what specific organism you're fighting.
Which means you can't tailor the antibiotics properly.
Right. You end up using broad-spectrum drugs for longer, potentially with more side effects and resistance issues.
Okay. Moving to imaging. You mentioned plain x-rays aren't great early on.
Yeah, they have a very limited role in early diagnosis.
Mm.
You might see some subtle changes like disc space narrowing or end plate erosion, but often significant bony changes don't show up for maybe 2, even 3 weeks after symptoms start.
Mm.
By then, a lot of damage could already be done.
So what's the go-to imaging test?
MRI with contrast. Gadolinium contrast. That's the undisputed gold standard.
Why MRI?
It's incredibly sensitive and specific for spondylolisthitis, somewhere around 95%. It shows inflammation of the bone marrow and soft tissues much, much earlier than x-rays. And it's fantastic for showing complications like an epidural abscess or cord compression.
What are the key things a learner should look for on the MRI?
You're looking for specific signal changes. Typically on the T1 weighted images, the infected bone and disc look dark, low signal. On T2 weighted images, they look bright or maybe intermediate high or intermediate signal, showing the fluid and inflammation.
And the contrast?
The contrast helps highlight the inflamed areas, especially defining the walls of an abscess. It really lights up the infection. Plus, MRI is essential for ruling out other things that can look similar clinically, especially tumors like metastatic cancer or primary bone tumors.
Okay. What if someone can't get an MRI, like they have a pacemaker or severe claustrophobia?
Then the next best option, though it's a significant step down in specificity, is usually a technetium bone scan, sometimes combined with a gallium scan. It can show areas of increased bone turnover or inflammation, but it won't give you that detailed anatomical picture like an MRI.
Right. So let's say the MRI looks very suspicious for infection, but those blood cultures came back negative, which happens half the time. What's the next step for a definitive diagnosis?
This is where you need tissue. The gold standard becomes a CT-guided biopsy.
How does that work?
Using CT imaging to guide them, an interventional radiologist passes a needle into the suspected area, usually the disc space or the infected bone, and takes samples.
And those samples go for?
Critically, for both culture and histopathology. Culture tries to grow the bug. Histopathology means the pathologist looks at the tissue under a microscope.
Why is the pathology part so important?
Because sometimes the cultures still don't grow anything. But the pathologist might see definitive signs of infection, like lots of inflammatory cells. Or, crucially, they might see specific features like granulomas, which strongly suggest infections like TB or brucellosis, guiding treatment even without a positive culture. It also helps rule out malignancy again.
And if that first biopsy is negative or inconclusive?
If your clinical suspicion remains high, you often have to repeat the biopsy. The yield isn't 100%, unfortunately.
Okay, before we jump into treatment specifics, let's quickly cover what else this could be, the differential diagnosis.
Right, because severe back pain is common. You always have to consider malignancy either primary bone tumors or, more commonly, metastatic cancer.
Makes sense. What else?
Inflammatory arthritis, like ankylosing spondylitis, can sometimes mimic it. A simple vertebral compression fracture, especially in older patients with osteoporosis, and sometimes just severe degenerative disc disease or spondylosis can present with intense pain, although usually without the systemic inflammatory signs.
So lots of possibilities. Which brings us to the red flags. What are the absolute do not miss worst case scenarios we're trying to prevent?
Two big ones. Permanent neurologic damage and overwhelming sepsis. Those are the killers here.
So any sign of neurologic deficit?
Any sign. Numbness, tingling, weakness that's progressing, any change in bowel or bladder function that's a surgical emergency until proven otherwise, needs immediate attention, usually urgent MRI and likely surgery.
And sepsis.
Same urgency. If the patient is hemodynamically unstable, low blood pressure, high heart rate, confusion, looking really sick, you have to act fast.
Okay, so how does that urgency affect the initial treatment plan? Let's start with the unstable, potentially septic patient.
Sepsis protocol kicks in immediately. Forget waiting for cultures right now. You need fluid resuscitation, fast, and start broad-spectrum IV antibiotics right away.
What kind of antibiotics, typically?
Usually something to cover MRSA, like vancomycin, plus something with good gram-negative coverage, often a third or fourth generation cephalosporin like ceftriaxone or cefepime. You hit hard and broad first, then narrow down later if cultures eventually grow something.
Okay, that's the unstable patient. What about the patient who is stable, has severe pain, maybe a fever, MRI looks like infection, but they're not septic?
That's where you try to hold off on antibiotics, if you can, until you've got those blood cultures drawn, and ideally, if needed, that CT-guided biopsy performed.
To get the specific bug.
Exactly, because the standard treatment duration is long old, typically 6 to 12 weeks of antibiotics, often starting IV, then maybe transitioning to oral. You really want that treatment tailored to the specific organism and its sensitivities if possible.
6 to 12 weeks. That's a long time.
It is. Bone infections are notoriously difficult to clear. You need prolonged treatment to eradicate it.
Now, what about non-operative versus operative treatment? Can most cases be managed without surgery?
For isolated spondylodysitis, meaning infection in the disc and bone, but without a significant epidural abscess or instability or neurological compromise, yes, most can be treated non-operatively.
How?
With the right long-term antibiotics, initially maybe some bed rest, and often external bracing for spinal support and pain control. The success rate for non-operative management in these cases is actually quite good, maybe around 80%.
Okay, 80% success without surgery for straightforward spondylodysitis, but the game changes completely if there's a spinal epidural abscess, right? Especially with neurodeficits.
Totally different ballgame. If a patient has an SEA and any neurological deficit, the standard of care is urgent surgical decompression and washout. You have to get the pressure off the spinal cord or nerves immediately.
Is there any situation where you might treat an SEA with just antibiotics?
It's controversial, but there's emerging evidence suggesting it might be an option, but only under very strict criteria. You need all three. One, the abscess has to be relatively small in MRI. Two, the patient must have absolutely no neurological deficits, zero. And three, you need a confirmed microbiological diagnosis, usually from positive blood cultures or maybe an aspiration, so you know exactly what bug you're treating effectively.
It's a very select group of patients.
Very select. And they need incredibly close monitoring. Any hint of neurologic worsening, they go straight to the OR. For most EAs, especially with any neurosymptoms, surgery is the way to go.
And after surgery for an abscess or debridement of osteo, how long did the antibiotics continue?
It depends on whether the bone was involved. If the surgery confirms it was mostly just the epidural space abscess, maybe some soft tissue, but the bone itself looked clean, Then maybe 2 to 4 weeks of post-op antibiotics is enough.
But if the bone was clearly infected?
Then you're back to that long course, typically 6 to 12 weeks, similar to the non-operative treatment for osteomyelitis, to make sure you sterilize the bone.
Wow. Okay, this has been a really comprehensive look at a complex area. Definitely highlights the need for vigilance. To kind of wrap things up, let's distill this down, maybe 5 key concepts that really capture the essence of diagnosing and thinking about spinal infections.
Sounds good. I think the first has to be understanding the difference based on age and vascularity. Vertebral osteomyelitis, predominantly in adults due to avascular discs, versus discitis being more common in kids with their vascular nucleus pulposus. Location follows blood flow.
Good one. Okay, second.
Recognizing the spinal epidural abscess as the major emergency. It's the compressive lesion that causes neurological deficits and often mandates urgent surgery.
Right. SEA means urgency. Third.
The utility of the inflammatory markers, ESR, CRP, and PCT. Using them not just for initial screening, but critically, using the trend, especially CRP, to monitor treatment response.
Makes sense. Watching the numbers. Fourth key takeaway.
The microbiology. Knowing as aureus is king, but always linking specific pathogens like Pseudomonas to IV drug use or Salmonella to sickle cell, and not forgetting TB and Brucella in the right context.
Got it. Specific bugs for specific situations. And finally, the fifth point.
When your non-invasive tests aren't giving you the answer, particularly when blood cultures are negative, remembering that CT-guided biopsy with culture and histopathology is the gold standard for getting a definitive tissue diagnosis. You got to get the tissue sometimes.
Excellent summary. Vertebral osteoverscistitis, SEA urgency, ESR-CRP-PCT trends, specific pathogens, and CT biopsy. That really covers the diagnostic pathway.
I think so.
And the final thought maybe to leave everyone with circles back to that diagnostic challenge we discussed.
Yeah, the fact that the classic SEA triad of fever, pain, and neurologic deficit is often incomplete.
Exactly. So the real clinical pearl is
maintaining that high index of suspicion based purely on persistent, severe, non-mechanical back pain, especially when combined with any relevant patient risk factors. You can't wait for flashing red lights. You have to suspect it early based on subtle clues.
That suspicion saves spines, saves lives.
Absolutely. Couldn't say it better.
Well, we have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia. That's Orthopedia by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayet. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us, read the book. You'll be glad you did.